The Guardian. Football Weekly.
Football Weekly, very extra. Today, we look back on the thrills and spills of the midweek action and controversy as... Oh. Today, we look forward to another big weekend in leagues across Europe as... Hey, you're kidding. Today, then, in the midst of a week so free of meaningful football, it could be from Arsenal's fixture list, we take a quick whiz around the weekend Euro qualifiers. Yes. Ask why Scotland have a home game in London. Ask why you have to bin Haman to bin Blatter. And thank heavens for your post. All of that, plus Championship Talk 2, incredibly enough, packed into one Football Weekly Extra. The air a crackle with enthusiasm as I survey the eager faces of Michael Cox of ZonalMarking.net.
Hi, James. How are you?
I'm ever so well, Michael, and it's lovely to see you.
Thank you.
You've been off, haven't you?
I have. I've been on a quick trip to Barcelona.
That's fantastic. You saw a Barcelona game.
I did, and I went to see a fourth division game as well.
Of course you did. Of course.
CE Europa, who play in the north of the city.
Right.
It was very nice.
Was it?
Okay. Yeah, it was a nice contrast. It was 90,000 compared to about 600 spectators at both games, I think. So,
right.
Yeah, it was nice.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. Paul McKinney is also in. Nice to see you again, Paul.
Hola.
Where have you been of late?
I've been in North America.
Have you?
Yes,
you've been at South
by Southwest, yes.
Yeah.
Looking at the future of music and the future of the digital world, James.
Right, that's coming up in part two today.
Yeah.
Were they playing much
tedious
football
digital
there?
Chat from Paul McKinnis. Yeah, yeah, no. Honestly, it's really interesting, but I'll tell you another time.
All right, okay. Barry, you're back as well.
I am.
What have you been up to, Barry?
Nothing.
So far we've had Barcelona and Austin, Texas.
I was in Brixton yesterday, because I lived there.
Right, excellent. See anyone?
No, I'll tell you, actually.
Hey.
I was on the tube on the way home yesterday, and I saw this guy, and he was quite obviously listening to a podcast.
No.
And he kept bursting out laughing, you know? So I was trying to...
Was it Gabriele Marcotti?
No. So I was trying to... I was thinking, oh, it couldn't be. And anyway... At my stop, I got off, and on the way past, I just sort of tapped him and said, "Look, you don't mind me asking, what are you listening to?" And it wasn't us.
Yeah. What was it? Because it sounds like it was quite funny.
Yeah, I think he said a spodcast or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Not something.
Somebody stopped me in a queue for a gig in Austin, Texas, and say, "Aren't you one of the guys on the football podcast?"
Really?
Yeah. He was from Malaysia. We shared a beer in the Friendly Fires gig, so hello to him if you're listening. Never got his name.
All right. Big shout out to Malaysia. Cool. Anyway, now, Toon Toon says, question for the fixture list people. How on earth did they manage to have us playing only two games in March, yet around five or six over Christmas and New Year? That is an interesting question, isn't it? It's a very empty, from the league point of view, but they're talking about Premier League, it's a very empty period, this, and yet Christmas was ever so jam-packed. Yeah. Well, that's a question, as I say, for the fixture list people.
There is something about Christmas, isn't there? There is a positive. People don't like to talk about it because the managers are so anti the Christmas period. But there is a positive case for the Christmas fixture list,
right?
Which is that there are people off work and they're able to go to games, and there's a bit more atmosphere around those Christmas games and the third round of the FA Cup,
right?
Which is probably why they haven't moved them out there.
It is a shame, though, especially with the glorious weather. Like, this is perfect football watching period, isn't it? And it seems a shame that we do have so many games crammed into winter nights when we're wrapped up in thermals, whereas t-shirt and jeans, it would be quite a nice experience watching this weekend. But then there's lower league games on, so
there certainly are.
We should give a push, go to your support your local non-league club or something, shouldn't we?
That's a very good idea. Or you can also follow those internationals. They are Euro 2012 qualifiers, and there's some big ones there. England, for example, having resolved a massive issue about who wears a piece of cloth around his arm.
And calls heads or tails.
Yeah, calls heads and tails.
It's a very important role, apparently.
Right. They'll be taking on Wales, sans Christian Bale, Gareth Bale. I always get that one right. But I think it's fair to say that Christian Bale won't be playing.
Blimey, I'm playing left back for Wales. Come on, guys.
Yeah, anyway.
Have you talked about that accent at the Oscars? That was the weirdest accent I've ever heard.
Okay, let's hear about Christian Bale at the Oscars.
No. It just was really weird. He did a total... You know, he's been living in the States for about 20 years, and he talks an American accent, by and large. You've seen The Rant. That's an American accent, yeah? Mm. He goes on at the Oscars, wins his award, and he's talking like he's been working at Billingsgate for the past 6 years.
He's an actor. But he's an actor.
But why put it on?
You're from Norwich and you talk like that as well a bit.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't switch. I'm consistent this. Yeah.
Well, I just think Christian Bale is a very strange man.
Anyway, Gareth Bale won't be playing in the game at the Millennium. It's my fault. I know. But anyway, so Wales, England. England currently second in the group behind Montenegro, but with a game in hand. This is a big match.
Could I just say something about Bale?
Which one? about Gareth. Right.
Did you see the tweet from the Wales assistant manager?
I did. Who is he calling amateurs?
Well, for those of you who didn't see the tweet, he said, "This morning there will be an official statement by Gary Speed about the situation with Gareth Bale. The incompetent amateurs strike again." And this guy is Raymond van Heijen, who is a Dutch fitness coach, and he's got this kind of agenda against a lot of big clubs, the way they train their players. He believes in this concept called periodization, which basically implies that less is more. He says that clubs basically train their players too much, and that especially clubs that have double training sessions in a day, they're basically overworking their players. He's a fitness coach, but he's got a football background, and he believes that 80% of injuries are caused... Sorry, 80% of injuries are preventable, and the main reason is overtraining and basically tiring the players. And there's some interesting stories about... He was appointed by Mark Hughes to be Manchester City's fitness coach at the start of last season. And he came in and Craig Bellamy was so unhappy with this and the new regime that he brought in. Craig Bellamy kept a six-week diary detailing what they did for training every day because he was going to use it to prove that this was all a load of nonsense. Craig Bellamy then went on to have his best ever season. Felt fantastic. And even after Verheijen left Manchester City, I think when Hughes left City, Bellamy employed him himself to be Bellamy's personal fitness coach. So he's a very strange character. There's a good interview with him on the BBC website, actually.
It is an interesting point, especially with some clubs seeing their campaigns in many ways hampered by recurring injuries. I'm thinking of Arsenal in particular. I don't know if they necessarily train harder than other clubs do. Manchester United picking up injury after injury as well.
He has Arsenal, one of the clubs he's criticised specifically, I believe.
All right.
Wasn't there a talk when Graeme Souness, like any club he manages, that players tend to drop like flies with injuries on a regular basis? Like Speed is big into, he's a sort of pro zone and he has nutritionists and performance analysts and sports scientists. He also has a GPS consultant, which is not something to do with sat-nav, but... and the players have to do daily...
What is it then?
Saliva, well, I'll explain a bit. Saliva, urine and blood tests. And then the results are put through a big machine with flashing lights and that dictates their workload. So.
I remember reading a big interview with David Moyes a few years ago and it was talking about all of that, and he had all his data, he had all his various fitness regime, he had people drinking wheatgrass smoothies, and still, you know, the Everton team is pretty much permanently half-knackered.
That is true.
I mean, don't you have to do a certain intensity of training in order to be able to get to the levels where you can compete at 90 minutes in the Premiership?
Perhaps. It's interesting. That's the word he mentions a lot, actually, intensity. He says because football is about moments of intensity, there's no point just training constantly over a long period of time. It reminds me of the swimmer, Mark Foster, actually. Don't know if you remember, about 2000, he sacked his old coach because Foster did 50-metre freestyle, so he was swimming for about 20 seconds in the races. His old coach had him going up and down the training pool for 2-3 hours at a time, and he sacked his coach, coached himself for the rest of his career, and he only ever did 15-minute bursts at a time and then got out and did some other work, and he was competing and succeeding very well into his late 30s, which is remarkable for a swimmer.
All right, well, that's a very interesting issue, that of what,
could you
Paul?
Apply it to journalism? Could, I say, Barry and I work in kind of more short, intense bursts rather than having to, say, do 9 to 5 on 5 days a week?
Right, wasn't that something that came up in the South by Southwest Festival, the whole nature of the way humans are being applied, almost like they are machines, whether they are actually you pulsing
read,
creatures?
You read that article, very
we
good,
should be
right
pulsing.
To the end.
I can't believe we were worried today. Today's podcast might be dull.
Yeah. Anyway, now, Gareth Bale not playing, apparently, in the game at the Millennium Stadium between Wales and England. Best player in the world, of course, as Fabio Capello himself dubbed him, and wants to take anything Fabio Capello says seriously, whether it's David Beckham will never play for me again at Real Madrid, or John Terry will never wear the captain's armband for me while I'm England manager, anything like that. What is it with Capello? He's clearly phoning it in and cashing the $6 million cheques, eh, Paul McInnes?
Well, I am always inclined to give people the benefit of the doubt, and I don't dislike Capello nearly as much as a lot of the number ones in the British press appear to. I certainly think there's a problem of translation. There is a problem with the language, and there's also a problem with his relationship with the press, quite clearly. Whether he cares what they think, whether he cares, I would imagine he doesn't all that much. Whether that's a problem, I'm not entirely sure. It all depends on whether he cares what the players think and whether the players are on side. I was away, and so I came back to see this photo of Rio with his mouth kind of all a squint, looking at Capello in the stands. Now, has this been proven to be an actual altercation, or could he have kind of been reacting to somebody else something else?
Fernand does just look like that normally.
Well, he might have just got murked.
By all accounts, it was a very well choreographed snub. Ferdinand didn't sit where he usually sits in Old Trafford, so that if Capello, who had sort of said, "I'll see you at the game," went to look for him, he wasn't there. So that would suggest it was a concerted snub. There seems to be a whole lot of tomfoolery going on between Rio Ferdinand's people and John Terry's people. And I don't know if there's animosity between the players or not, but their agents and representatives certainly seem to be very, very upset about this England captaincy farce. But I think Capello now, he has a split camp. That's his fault. His management of England thus far has been hopelessly inept. And like you say, Jimbo, he's phoning it in for the $6 million and he should be got rid of.
I think you've got to blame the players more than the coach. You've got to. I mean, these splits within the camp are between players, isn't it? And that's what was going on in the World Cup. There was obviously some people who were supporting Terry in his little protest, and then other people who backed away, and it looked like there was a north-south divide. I'm not entirely sure that those same groups of people are still in and around the squad. They're obviously not seeing eye to eye in terms of Ferdinand and Terry. So what is that? I mean, obviously, Capello should be looking.
Why would they care? I mean, they just come together to play a game. Why does anybody care about any of this?
Because they're monstrous egos who have been mollycoddled for their entire adult and indeed their adolescent lives.
There are supplicants,
succubi, who make their living off of keeping these people's egos boosted.
Mm.
And obviously, Capello should be doing something about that. I'm very reluctant to blame him.
You think this is the kind of manifestation of a battle of egos within the England camp?
And also a manifestation of this celebrity age. I mean, that's why I'm disappointed with Capello post-World Cup, is that he hasn't moved on. He hasn't kind of put Cahill and Dawson in there.
Well, what about the squad then? We have Mitchell Sterling saying, "Oh dear, Mr. Zonal Marking Michael Cox," or has someone called you Zona Mister? Brilliantly the other day.
Very nice.
Should Capello go with Lennon to curb Bale's enthusiasm? Should he try Wilshere and Parker together in the middle with Jarvis and Lennon on the flanks and Rooney just to be in by Carroll? How would you line up England then, Michael?
I'd like to see Scott Parker given a go, actually.
Yeah.
I think if we're building the side around Wilshere, I'm not entirely sure that is the case yet, but I expect Wilshere to start. He hasn't started a competitive game yet. But I'm not sure he alongside Lampard would work particularly well.
So you'd have Wilshere there in the kind of holding role, is that right?
Well, the trend at the moment seems to be to play two who kind of dovetail in that role a little bit,
right,
like Schweinsteiger and Khedira did at the World Cup. And Arsenal have done that this season, having played Song as the main holding player last year. But I think Parker deserves a go. He's getting on a bit now. I think is he just about 30 now?
I think he is 30, yeah.
But he's had a fantastic couple of seasons for West Ham. He's all action. I think he's the kind of player we need in the centre of the park. He's not going to go missing. And I think he now falls in the category of an experienced player, which I think Wilshere needs alongside him.
Right.
I'm not sure about Jarvis. He's a good player. He's had a good season. I'm not sure I'd respond to this game. I think so. Capello has he's experimented with three central midfielders in the friendlies since the World Cup. But in the three competitive games, he's stuck to two up front. It'll be interesting to see who it is.
Mm.
Would you play Carroll?
I'd still go with Benton and Rooney for now, I think, because I thought in the most recent games they looked like they were beginning to, well, certainly Bent appeared to be acclimatising to the
world. Well, that was the 0-0 with Montenegro, and then the defeat to
not the friendlies,
right? Okay,
scored twice, I think.
Yeah. It's also worth pointing out that as well as replacing someone as captain, John Terry is also replacing someone as centre back because he hasn't started a competitive game since the World Cup. Les Scott has played twice, Jagielka has played twice, and Dawson and Ferdinand have played once. So it'll be interesting to see who his partner is.
Wales.
I think the Wales team looks pretty good on paper, and it could end up being a right old championship ding-dong, just with the personnel involved. But I was looking at the squad, and I'm not familiar enough with some of the names in it to know who's going to come in for Gareth Bale. So.
Over to you, Michael.
I must say, I really don't know. They've played Bale left wing all three games.
Ah.
So I'm not sure who the backup is.
I say don't have a left winger.
Might work.
That would have, then you'd have Ramsey, Vaughan, Bellamy in midfield.
Right.
Ramsey versus Wilshere would be an interesting battle in the central midfield.
Also this weekend at the Emirates, Scotland play Brazil. Quite why Scotland are having a home match with the Seleção in London is a question that we now propose to ask Ewan Murray. Hello.
Morning, James. Afternoon, James. How are you?
Yeah, good day to you, Ewan.
And you?
Yep, you're well.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to sun-drenched London at the weekend.
Yeah, it is sun-drenched. And how nice for Scotland to share their home games with the capital. Quite why is this fixture taking place at the Emirates?
Well, it's not a home game. It's Brazil's home game. So.
But it's listed as Scotland-Brazil.
It shouldn't be. Mm. Where is it listed as Scotland-Brazil?
It is. That's what confuses me. If it were Brazil-Scotland, I'd go, yeah, this is just part of Brazil's world tour, which is kind of capped out at the Emirates.
That's essentially what it is.
Oh, all right, OK. There you go. But there'll be no shortage of Scottish fans there, one imagines. A lot of excitement about this game.
Yeah, I mean, that's twofold. There's a lot of Scots will travel. There's a lot of Scots in London, and there's a lot of Brazilians in London.
Yeah.
So I can't remember. I think the last ticket numbers I saw were just short of 50,000.
Right.
So it won't be too far off capacity if not completely full. So right. Yeah, it should be a great occasion.
And Scotland coming off some reasonable results. They're only losing 3-2 to Spain in October, and then back-to-back victories over the Faroe Islands and Northern Ireland, and not conceding goals in either.
Yeah, what came before that, of course, was the debacle in Prague where Craig Levein infamously played with zero strikers. But they came back from that well, played well against Spain. Faroe Islands, they played well, but of course the standard of opposition has to be taken into account. They beat Northern Ireland very comfortably. Again, Northern Ireland were depleted. But there are signs of encouragement, and thankfully signs, you know, for the first time in a while that Scotland can go out and attack teams and don't have to play with, you know, so many men behind the ball all the time. They can go on the front foot, and the creative forces of guys like Charlie Adam becoming more and more important.
What are you looking to see then from this game? A fixture, of course, in which Scotland have a bit of an illustrious history.
Yeah, well, but they're still to beat Brazil, haven't they? So I mean, that's maybe asking for too much. What I do want is to see a bit more life than sometimes you get in these games, dare I say it. They can become non-events on the pitch, if that makes sense. So I hope there's a bit more to it. And obviously, Scotland are on a kind of steady improvement. I'm anxious not to say that they're getting better and better at any great rapid rate, but they are in a steady improvement. If they can keep that going, then it can augur well for their championship campaign, European championship qualifying campaign doesn't start again till September, so there's a big, big break. But they go back to the Carling Nations Cup at the end of in the middle of May. So if they can keep the improvement going before those qualifiers start again, then I think there's cause for optimism.
I'm just wondering what the options are goal scorer wise for Scotland at the moment.
Kenny Miller or Kenny Miller.
Yeah, it's odd that, isn't it? Why? What happened to people like Boyd and Fletcher on the international
Stephen
stage?
Fletcher had a slight fallout with the manager. Stephen Fletcher spoke to the newspaper about his unhappiness at being left out of the game against the Czech Republic. Craig Levein was none too happy about him doing that. And then, in fact, it was the Northern Ireland game. Stephen Fletcher said that he didn't want to be considered for selection. So he won't be back, certainly as far as I'm concerned, while Craig Levein's the manager, unless there is a make-up happens there, and I can't see that happening.
Right.
Chris Boyd has struggled, really, hasn't he, since he left Rangers. He didn't do much at Middlesbrough. He's been farmed out to Nottingham Forest.
Scored a nice five-inch tap-in at the weekend, though. So
yeah, I mean, that's what he's good at. Craig Levein would simply argue that his form hasn't been worthy of a place in the national team, the national squad.
Chris Uwaluma?
Yeah, he kind of comes and goes.
Right.
I mean, what they really need, they need someone. I mean, the point is, they've favoured one up so many times, and Miller plays that role well, and it suits him. If they could find an ideal partner for Miller, you know, I think Craig Levein would play with two and be a bit more adventurous. But such a player hasn't appeared. Fletcher, for me, is frustrating, because I think Stephen Fletcher's a really good player. But, you know, A, he's struggled to get into the Wolves team on a regular basis, and B, there has been this minor spat, shall we say, with Craig Levein, and that's saddening, because he's, what, a £7 million striker, and for Scotland to have one of them and not have him in the national team, you know, that seems a bit sad.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Brazil squad, of course, including such illustrious names as Lucio and Maicon and David Luiz, of course, all at the back, Dani Alves. Yeah.
There was a suggestion, which unfortunately hasn't come to pass, was a suggestion that Ronaldo the other Ronaldo was going to make a farewell appearance for Brazil in this game.
He's saving that one, I think, for the kind of testimonial. Is it Romania they're playing it in?
Yeah, I mean, the fairness, there seems a little point in him turning up in London to do that. It'd be better to do it a bit closer to home.
Yeah.
But that would have added intrigue to it if that had come to pass.
Certainly would. Ewan, fantastic stuff. So you're going to the game?
Yep, weekend in London.
All right, lovely.
I'm taking the Factor duffel coat.
Yeah, enjoy the big smoke.
I will do. Good to speak to you.
Nice one. Thanks, Ewan.
Cheers.
And with that, we come to the end of part one. Part two features the vocal talents of Sid explaining Spain's game against the Czechs and why the Liga is just about to postpone the next series of league matches. TV dispute. Also, Barry's going to be talking to us about Ireland Macedonia. Right, part two. Lots of other internationals happening. We're going to pick out one or two of the choicest. Northern Ireland will be playing Serbia in Serbia, which will be fun. The game played behind closed doors, of course, after Serbia's antics, no pun intended, in the in their recent trip to Genoa to take on Italy. You recall the riot, the game abandoned, fixture awarded 3-0 to the Azzurri. Exciting game this. Nigel Worthington's men are unbeaten in three Euro qualifiers, but they've only won one of their last 15 internationals. Apparently they were 1-0 win at Slovenia in September 2010. And all sorts of big names in the Serbia side, aren't there? Zigic. Yeah,
big guy.
Yeah. And
a lot of good defenders.
Vidic will be out injured, but lots of other ones, Michael A.
Yeah, they've got Ivanovic, the Chelsea player.
Yep.
And they've got Subotic, who's been very good for Borussia Dortmund this season.
Excellent.
If Jonathan Wilson was here, he'd be able to tell us all about the interview he did with the Serbian manager about the Serbs' need to polish up the image of the game and their national side, which is on the website.
Yeah, it certainly is.
And well worth a read.
It's an interesting read. The Italians, actually, we mentioned the fact that this game here with Northern Ireland is behind closed doors. The Italians will be playing in Slovenia. They're quite concerned at Serbian fans making the trip there to exact some sort of revenge for Italy having participated in their recent humiliation. Italy, of course, topping that group ahead of Slovenia. And just speaking about, you know, the captaincy issue for England, of such little consequence in other nations. For example, Daniele De Rossi is not even called up this time, even though he has been Italy captain, because of the whole discipline issue and the fact that Cesare Prandelli has decided to once more exercise the often unspoken rule in Italy that if you are in disciplinary trouble with your club, you don't get a call-up.
And also on that note, Robinho captained Brazil in the last game against France and has been dropped for this game as well.
Balotelli, in case you're wondering, is the other player who's not been called up under the new Prandelli ethics hard line. There you go. Ireland, in the meantime, are taking on Macedonia. Tell us more, Barry.
Well, Ireland is second in the group. They're 7 points after four games. Russia are top with 9. And Macedonia are 5th out of 6. They're 4 from 4. So this game's quite interesting in that if Kevin Kilbane starts, and many hope he won't, but if he starts, and it's sort of between him and Kieran Clark from Aston Villa as to who gets the left-back berth, it will be Kilbane's 65th consecutive competitive international.
Wow.
He hasn't missed one since 1999, I think. And it will be his 109th cap. So,
wow.
Yeah, they're pretty astonishing figures. Ireland played a four-man midfield their last game against Russia and got overrun and beaten. And I think Portsmouth's Liam Lawrence told the press that they might have to change it and was promptly slapped down by Marco Tardelli.
Well, he's been quite vocal, hasn't he, Liam Lawrence? He's also been speaking out on the issue of players juggling their nationality after, Jermaine Pennant and Jamie O'Hara and floated the notion that they might turn out for Ireland, having been snubbed by England.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ironic because Liam Lawrence is born in Nottingham and didn't make his senior debut. I think he was 27 or 28. But yeah, he was criticising O'Hara and Pennant and players like them who tried to declare for Ireland for no other reason than that they're not good enough to play for England.
Is he right?
I think if they... I'd love to have Jamie O'Hara in the Irish team.
Mm.
And Pennant has his uses as well on his day. But... if they're happy to play for Ireland and you know, we'll have them if they qualify.
I think right. I think there's been a couple of England under 21 lads, Victor Moses, Onua at Sunderland, who've both declared for Nigeria recently as well. So I just think that's the state of the modern game, isn't it? I mean, people do that all the time. It is a fact of life now. I would side with Lawrence in regretting that being a fact of life, but I think it is.
Yeah. Well, I would include having a foreign manager as you know, in charge of your national team, very much part of that. Thiago Motta is another big example. Brazilian.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, yeah, the Italian international.
Yeah.
I suspect Jermaine Pennant and Jamie O'Hara aren't the sharpest tools in the shed, but they...
Jermaine Pennant, not the sharpest tools in the shed.
But
I think he left the car in Ireland about 6 years ago. That's qualified for residency.
It's been in the car park in Dublin Airport for long enough to make him eligible. But yeah, they should be a bit more... what's the word?
Discreet?
Discreet, yeah. Right. You know, don't let it be known. You know, put a pig under their arm and dance around a lot and, you know, pretend it's always been their dream to play for Ireland.
Right.
There must be some more players around that they could find with Irish heritage.
There's usually a Brazilian or two. Davey MC says, I would take them, I would nationalise all the Brazilian workers in the meat factories around the country if it meant us going to a championship. I mean, Brazil's got so many players, they don't know what to do with them all. Even Spain take Brazilians, goodness sake.
I think there'll probably be a lot of Brazilians moving to Qatar soon, won't they?
Yeah. Yeah, well, their side not already fairly stuffed?
Yeah, a few Argentines and a couple of other South Americans.
Mm. So Brazilians go to Ireland to work in meat factories? Mm-hmm. Is that, do they qualify because of their expertise in steak and
I don't
barbecue?
Know. I believe the county Wexford in Ireland is just more Brazilians there now than there are Irish people. So I mean, I'm just waiting for the first All-Ireland hurling final where we see black players and Brazilians and whatnot, you know, waving their sticks around.
Right.
I'd qualify for Ireland, actually, and I'm up for a game. So
right, there you go. Yeah. Well, the pitcher knowledge.
We might find a coaching backroom role for you. I don't think you'd march into the starting 11.
Now, we've mentioned Italy's game with Slovenia. France are taking on Luxembourg. Not necessarily the most eye-catching of fixtures, except for the fact that the World Cup rebels Patrice Evra and Franck Ribéry are now once more free to play, and they've been called up again, expected to feature for Les Bleus. France, of course, top of the group and doing very well under the auspices of Laurent Blanc. Lovely. Spain, in the meantime, who've won every single game since the World Cup, I think I'm right in saying, in competitive fixtures, but have had one or two slip-ups in recent friendlies, losing to Argentina and Portugal. Joining us now from somewhere, I'm guessing in Spain, is Sid Lowe. Sid, where are you?
Hello, James. How are you? I'm in Madrid.
Oh, okay.
And tomorrow morning I'll be on a train on my way down to Granada to see Spain play against the Czech Republic on Friday night.
All right. Is this going to be a good game? It's one of the better-looking fixtures.
Yeah, and for Spain it matters because, of course, this is the game that could pretty much tie up qualification for them, and then they can start treating their other games as if they were friendlies, which isn't necessarily a good thing to do considering the way they've been playing in friendlies recently. But it is an important one. One or two interesting kind of aspects to it as well in terms of Torres will start. Will Torres finally get a goal after his slightly difficult start at Chelsea and reasonably difficult time at with the Spanish squad over the last couple of years as well. But yeah, it looks like it could be quite good fun.
All right. There's always a dog, isn't there, Sid?
There is always a dog, and ridiculously, it's not even Stella this time. I'm just walking past someone's house, and they've clearly got a very big dog.
Right. The Czechs lie second in group, boasting 6 points. Their only blemish, he said, reading off a piece of paper, coming when they surprisingly lost 1-0 at home to Lithuania.
Yes. Yeah. Ooh. Now, to be honest, I can't tell you very much more about that, except for, yes, they did lose 1-0 at home to Lithuania.
But Del Bosque says they're our biggest threat. They have great physical and technical qualities. Barry?
Sid, why is the game being played in Granada? Seems an odd
because
place.
the Spanish FA always do this. There's a long answer and a short answer. The short answer is there isn't a national stadium in Spain. Therefore, they play all over the place. The longer answer is that because of the nature of the Spanish Football Federation, where the president is voted in by regional federations, essentially, you know, it's essentially a vote per federation. Of course, he has to keep local federations happy, which is why we get this bizarre situation of the Spanish national team playing sometimes in some really tin pot stadiums in relatively small cities. They travel around the country. They try and choose big stadiums for the games that are really, really, really big, but they have been all over the place. I've seen them in the last couple of years alone in places like Albacete, this one Granada, in Murcia, in Salamanca, in places that really and truly are not in Elche, in places that are really not big cities.
Granada, lovely town though. Always nice to go to
Granada. Granada's beautiful. Yeah, Granada's very, very nice indeed. The stadium, I must admit, I've never been there, but it's pretty little and it's out of town, and so I don't really know what to expect. But it does mean I hopefully get a new mug.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
And that's
news.
All that really matters.
It is.
Nothing else matters, James.
Nothing. I want curly hair too, says Sid Lowe. Secretly, yes, but
let's it doesn't need secondary hair of any kind. It can be any kind of hair.
Any kind, yeah. Says Sid Lowe. I wonder if he'd named himself that just to see if I would read it out.
Yeah.
I want curly hair too.
You know what? He's like Bart Simpson ringing up Moe's Tavern, isn't he? He's done it just to hear you say it.
IP freely.
Yeah.
Yes. See more butts.
See more butts. Hello, everyone, I want to see more butts, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Anyway, can we hear your thoughts, says aforementioned poster, on the Spanish TV dispute?
You'd have to be pretty clever to hear my thoughts. That's quite bizarre.
Well, not if you articulate them through, you know.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
Thank you.
Sorry. Yeah.
Will the season's last games really be played on the 12th of June? It all seems kind of crazy. This is all over the TV rights battle after the next round of Spanish league matches. Sid, as you're probably aware, has been postponed due to this ongoing dispute over the television revenue.
It's a complete and utter shambles. It really is a shambles. And essentially what's happened is, let's put this into context. As it currently stands, it's true that the next round of games won't be played, so everything will be moved forward a week. Now, everything being moved forward a week in Spain is kind of problematic because the Spanish season finishes the week before the Champions League final. The week after the Champions League final is internationals. So in other words, the Spanish season would have 1 week left. It would stop and wait for two more weekends of games before it starts up again for one round of games, which would be well into June. This is happening because the Spanish football clubs, or the Spanish league as a collective, but we'll get onto the arguments in a second. Basically, the Spanish football clubs as a whole, but not all of them, are saying, we don't want there to be an open to free-to-air TV game every week protected by the government. So we're going to go on strike. Now, funnily enough, when the Spanish Players Union threatened to go on strike not so very long ago, all the Spanish clubs, which essentially is effectively the companies as against the workers, said this is a shambles, it can't possibly happen, you're going to cause so much damage. 4 or 5 weeks later, when they think, oh, it might be a good idea, this, they've forgotten all of those arguments that they put forth back then. Now, this isn't entirely clear-cut because, as I just said, this is the Spanish league saying it, but there are, I think I'm right in saying, six clubs who are saying, no way, and they've asked the Federation, please give us referees, please give us a time, we want to go ahead with our games. Funnily enough, Madrid and Barcelona, who, oh look, just so happen to get a nice break ahead of their most important games of the season, are the ones most behind this, as always.
Behind the strike?
Behind the strike, yeah.
Yeah. And this is about the free-to-air game rather than, say, the split of the TV revenue, which goes largely into Real Madrid and Barcelona's pockets.
Exactly. So what this is essentially one of the reasons why there's a battle every single week about who shows Spanish football on TV, because the games are split across a series of platforms. Essentially, the reason why there's a battle is because one is always shown free-to-air, and that one is protected by a law that essentially talks about general interest, and therefore one game a weekend has to be free to air. Now they're arguing that this is bad for us because we could make more money if it was all on subscription channels, as it is in other countries. What they're saying is they're trying to pressure the government, and they're saying to the government, well look, this isn't fair, we want to be able to have it entirely private, we don't think it's right that you should say at least one game a week has to be shown to the whole country, even though of course they do still make money out of that game. They're acting as if they don't make any money from it. They do. And so we want government help, and if you don't do it, we're going to go on strike, and it's going to cause a massive mess. The sports minister, I thought, gave the greatest possible response, which was, ah, okay then. Well, may I remind you that you currently collectively owe well over 650 million euros in unpaid taxes.
Wow. Will the strike happen, Sid?
I suspect not. I think it's too messy. I think it's not unanimous enough, the support for the strike within the La Liga club. So as I say, Sevilla, Athletic Bilbao, Villarreal, Espanyol, and one other who I've forgotten off the top of my head are all against it. They're asking for the strike not to happen. I think it probably won't. But what it is doing, of course, is it means that we are, 10 days away from the next round of games. We don't know whether they'll go ahead. Then, once the decision is made for them to go ahead, if indeed it is made, we still won't know if they play Saturday, Sunday, Monday, or indeed possibly even on Friday, in Real Madrid's case against Sporting Gijón, to give them extra days rest ahead of facing Spurs in the Champions League. So it's an almighty mess. And the sad thing is, of course, not for the first time, the Spanish League is a shambles.
Sid, sorry to hear about all that. Enjoy your trip to Granada.
I will. I'll be heart in mouth until I find a club shop with mugs.
Right, indeed. Yeah, best of luck with that. Sid Lowe in Spain, everybody.
Cheers, James.
Cheers. That brings us to the end of part two. Coming up in part three, Paul McInnes' long-awaited update on the emergency loan signing deadline day in the Championship.
6 hours till emergency loan signing deadline.
All right. We'll have live updates on that very shortly. And we'll have Owen Gibson popping in to talk to us about FIFA. Battle FIFA, in fact. Part three. Owen Gibson joins us. Hi, Owen.
Hello there.
Hello. You were at the FIFA conference last week.
Almost right. UEFA Congress in Paris.
You were at the UEFA Congress in Paris last week. Still, I bet the buffet was pretty good.
It was that gripping. Everyone was clearly following every word I wrote from the UEFA Congress in Paris.
Right.
The buffet was good, though, yeah.
How was it? How good was it? Because we joke about it, but is it really special at a UEFA buffet?
The segregation between the press and the UEFA suits seems to have gone up a level, so we get less, they get more.
Oh, right. Surely it should be equal.
It should be equal.
Should very much be equal. Now, the reason that you were there was to do with Platini being re-elected and also the presence of the two men fighting, a bit like the two naked figures by the far side and Women in Love, Bin Hammam and that man Blatter.
That's a really unpleasant image. That's a really unpleasant image.
Tussling.
But that's right, sweatily. Yeah. Both Mohammed Bin Hammam was launching his media offensive, which basically consists of saying that he wants to bring transparency and change to FIFA, but not really illuminating us much beyond that as to what that might mean. And Blatter, who gave his usual sort of speech, which no one could quite follow, about how he hadn't started the mission that he began in however many years it was now, 15 years ago, and he needed four more years to complete his mission. Right. I think the reason this probably hasn't caught the imagination of the wider football public yet is that you're dealing with two men who've been at FIFA for a very long time, fighting over leading FIFA for even longer. So but
this is the thing, because after especially the awarding of the World Cups, and particularly the one to Qatar, I think a lot of people were thinking, well, it is time for change. But when the change is represented by the bloke from Qatar who was instrumental in that decision, are we right then to be disinterested in this? Is there any possibility for change beyond this?
There's one view that's, I mean, the Grant Wall campaign won't actually, you know, go anywhere, but it's been a really useful exercise in at least getting people to talk about the issues and to talk about the fact there is no sort of credible candidate for change. I mean, there is one view that says anyone but Blatter's got to be better, and I think that's probably right. You know, Bin Hammam is younger. He has got some good ideas about the fact that he wants to bring the club game more into FIFA rather than being at war with it all the time. And you know, I think he would represent a change of sorts, but it'd be a very incremental change. And as you say, he was the most vociferous in his criticism of the Sunday Times investigation into FIFA, which resulted in two of their number being suspended for corruption. It's very hard to get suspended for corruption if you work for FIFA. And
promoted is usually the reason.
Indeed. And he's been at the heart of that system for 15 years, up to the point that he even sort of ran Blatter's campaigns in 98 and 2002. So
why is the most popular sport in the world? Why is it always governed by these figures who kind of come out of nowhere and are completely unaccountable and then laugh all the way to the bank?
It's partly, I think, because we only ever get interested when it suits us, when there's an English World Cup bid or when there's a decision that particularly exercises us, and in between they pretty much get on with business, and the business is largely building their own power base, kind of sitting on these innumerable committees that allow them to sort of build up power over time. And the problem is that Sepp Blatter's largely run it like a complete dictator. And he's handed out patronage, and the only way to get on is to win his patronage, you know?
Right, that's the route to power, not say hosting a popular football podcast, anything like that. No. Well, blind alley, professionally speaking.
Give it 10-15 years, you know.
Right. Okay.
I'm not sure what there might be a FIFA committee for humorous football podcasts.
Right, if only.
Well, if I could add my two cents to sizzling football admin chat. I see Michel Platini got re-elected as head of UEFA unopposed, and he said that, well, one of the priorities for his mandate will be the fight against fraud linked to betting and match fixing.
All right.
Which leads us nicely to the weekend Serie B game between Atalanta and Piacenza.
Yeah, well, they've got a couple of fixtures under investigation. Owen was just actually mentioning this. There's always a couple of fixtures under investigation because of suspect betting patterns.
I mean, I think it's a really interesting and probably much bigger story than we've even sort of scratched the surface of yet, because, you know, clearly this has been endemic in some leagues across Europe, particularly at lower tiers, if you like. I mean, things have been written about the Russian league, things have been written about Finland, things have been written about the lower reaches of the Italian game for some time.
Some international games as well.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, and these sort of international friendlies that are sort of put together by rights agencies often, and for often, it seems now, for the benefit of illegal bookmakers. So, I mean, I think there's a lot more to go on this, and both UEFA and FIFA. UEFA talked about it a lot at their Congress this week. There's a FIFA, the two-day FIFA summit on it this weekend, which will be, again, riveting, no doubt. but it is obviously coming centre stage, and it's something that can only really be tackled by governments, which is why football...
How would they tackle it?
Well, you have to have sort of international cooperation on... It's an Interpol matter, basically. Mm. You're looking at sort of international organised crime syndicates, and you've got to try and get into them and work out how they're making their money and how they're laundering it. It's not an easy task, but it's going to take coordination on a sort of global level between sort of IOC, Interpol, UN level to actually start to make a difference.
Mm. So actually regulating the games from the point of view of FIFA or UEFA is a non-starter.
Well, there's things that can be done, aren't there, as in cricket. You know, you can try not to have meaningless games that mean absolutely nothing and are played for no reason apparently other than for the benefit of match fixers.
Don't take those, that's all we've got this week. You've got to go off and do some proper work, haven't you?
I'm afraid.
All right then. Very interesting. Owen also saying that he felt that there was a little bit of a ripple of dissent. He might have used the wrong word. I don't know. After the Qatar award, but to an extent the Russia one as well, and the sponsors beginning to get a little bit cold feet about FIFA, and they've now changed their mind again. But he said that's the only way that he thought change would ever come, if the money men decided to turn their backs. Barry, you want to know? We were talking about who you would have as your FIFA president.
God. Elle McPherson.
That's a good choice, I have to say. Oh, Ellie McPherson.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
I tell you, if you wanted a cross-media proposition,
yes,
you could do worse than Charlie Sheen.
No, right,
you could get Charlie Sheen and all his warlocks and all the various beasts that inhabit his mind.
You'd have transparency then.
Certainly have transparency. Michael? Translucent face.
I'd like to see football players actually go into administration.
Mm-hmm. Like Platini?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I think
Blatter's a football player.
Supposedly.
He was a Swiss international, wasn't he?
Not international, was he?
I think he was, wasn't he?
Would you like to see Alan Shearer
country.
Running the
News
FA?
News to me.
He was a player.
Hey, no, he did play.
Yeah.
But I don't think he was an international.
Right. I don't think Michael means Alan Shearer, to answer your question.
Andy Gray?
These are all options.
You suggested earlier, James, that Sean Ingle might make FIFA president. The betting things and the goal. There'll be lots of goal line technology and a lot more betting scandals.
Yeah.
And suspicious betting patterns.
Anyway, we'll move on now to the hot topic of the day, which is the emergency loan signing deadline day in the Championship.
And all the league, all the Football League clubs.
Yeah, yeah, and all the Football League clubs. They've all been at it, those Championship promotion contenders, haven't they?
Crazy at it, yeah. Well, not really.
Well, no, they're picking up all sorts of exciting players.
Well, it is quite interesting that rather than at the beginning of the season, when a lot of Premier League sides appear to be, because of the changes in the squad rulings and stuff, holding on to their younger players and blooding them a little bit, at the end of the season, in this loan window, which I don't think even the most ardent fans really knew about until last year, but has now become more important, you see that particularly the clubs chasing promotion stroke playoffs have been picking up those sorts of players who either sit on benches or make fleeting Premiership cameos, or alternatively are really good in Championship Manager, now signing with our clubs till the end of the season.
Give us some examples.
Well, Norwich City yesterday signed Danny Pacheco, this Liverpool guy who was the star of the under-19 European Championship and is supposed to be a little magician, but has never cracked the first team. He's only 5'6" tall and maybe coming towards to toughen up a little bit. Brendan Rodgers used his Chelsea connections, which got in Scott Sinclair in the summer, to get this Fabio Barini striker, who again hasn't really played but scored 2 goals on his debut. Burnley got Nelson Defuneso, Del or Nath or whatever, at Aston Villa. But he, again, good prospect, England under 21, scored in the Premiership, I think, a couple of times this season. Barry Bannon, another Aston Villa guy who was briefly made a name for himself, gone to Leeds. The one team who really appear to be pushing and haven't done some business is Forest, which I know is concerning a lot of Forest fans.
Mm. All right, ahead of what looks to be a very, very tight,
very tight
promotion playoff,
very tight indeed
battle.
Nobody's been consistent apart from QPR. I think QPR are now 9 points clear at the top.
And Norwich currently in the other automatic promotion.
Yeah,
place.
I mean, we're consistent in terms of our level of performance, but we haven't previously had a cutting edge.
Are you ready for the Premier League, Paul? Are you?
Well, I think Paul Lambert is ready for the Premier League. Whether our club's changed an awful lot in the last 2 years, as I'm sure you're aware, we were at our lowest point in 50 years. We're now everybody's abuzz. So I think now's as good a time as ever because the parachute payment structure changes from next year, so it's going to be a lot easier for people to do a yo-yo and a lot more difficult to crack into that group.
Because it's more money for parachute payments?
More money for parachute payments last longer.
Okay, and why is the transfer window longer for the Football League clubs than the Premier League?
Well, it's emergency loans, and I think it's... I don't know the precise genesis of it, but I think it's to offer some kind of solace to people who can't necessarily afford transfer fees.
Excellent. Well, no Championship football, of course, this weekend because they're on international break.
Yes.
League One, League Two are in action. As Michael, you were saying earlier, get along, see some other league football.
Or Spanish Fourth Division, if you're up for it.
Yeah, yeah. We haven't talked about your trip to Barcelona, have we?
Which game did you watch? Which Barcelona game?
It was the game against Getafe.
Right.
It was nice, actually, because it was the first game after... the news about Eric Abidal was announced. So it was a very nice atmosphere. Good tributes to him before.
Brings us full circle in the pod because there's Barcelona Getafe and the England Getafes this weekend type thing. I'll just finish on a post so as not to have that thing, the final
lingering
thing. Frank Stain says, looks like the only one of the major European leagues to have a meaningful title race this season will be Serie A. Might do, might not. Varmint Ratscallion says, following King Kenny's Liverpool revival, can the pod tell us if managers who have been out of the game for 2+ years tend to fare well in a new job compared to serial managers? I'm curious if the reflection time makes a better manager. What do you think, Michael? Sprung that on you, didn't I?
That's a horrible question to spring on someone.
I can't think of any more examples off the top of my head.
Because people don't usually come back after a long time out. Kevin Keegan would be one.
Yes, and a lot of people link the two of them, but there was a big difference because Dale Gleish had... I think he said he'd seen every Liverpool game in the past five years. Whereas Keegan said he hadn't seen a football game for 2 years or something and was running a circus.
Before and after.
Well, didn't Ian Holloway keep banging on about when he was sacked by Leicester and had it? I know it was only a year out of the game, but he used that year to build chicken coops and change his entire philosophy about the game and how he approached it.
I hadn't heard the bit about chicken coops.
Oh, yeah, he's very handy with timber. And he
keeps chickens.
And he keeps chickens, and he built a massive chicken coop. If you were a chicken, that is where you'd want. That would be the most exclusive accommodation you could live in,
I think. The interesting one is Alan Kerbishley, if he never gets another job, what he'd be like. Never really let anybody down.
Fair enough. That is it, then, for today's Football Weekly Extra. Many, many thanks to Paul McInnes. And to Michael Cox and Barry Glendening. I know there's loads of other things we had to talk about, which has run out of time. And many thanks, producer Pascal. We'll be back on Monday with our review of all the many excitements awaiting us in the next couple of days. And I look forward to those midweek internationals too. So join us then. A European paper review up on Friday morning, if you like. Otherwise, see you on Monday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.